The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So just nod silently if E.E. Cummings was the first poet you ever read, or that you devoured John Cheever. I'm Toby Dichter, proud to be chair of the Foundation Board of Directors here at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And my mother, in whose honor this lecture is, introduced me to both E.E. Cummings and John Cheever, and she would have loved tonight. She especially would have loved the conversation with our wonderful author. I can't believe we have such a legacy of American literature with us tonight. I think it really represents the magic this institution has brought to Philadelphia. We are on the cusp of change and the forefront of democracy and education. We service people from all ages in every neighborhood, from strollers to walkers. I have just coined that phrase, so remember where you heard it. We offer educational programs, books, musical scores, for those of you who didn't know. If Susan Smith is here, she's introduced me to that concept, DVDs, and so much more. And this month, we've been enrolling citizens in the Affordable Care Act and providing shelter in every neighborhood. And that is librarians who voluntarily were trained in that tedious process that we have them to thank. So I needn't say again, because we're preaching to the choir, but please give as generously as you can and as often as you can to the Free Library of Philadelphia. And tonight's author, Susan Cheever, is absolute proof that if you grow up with passionate literature, love of books in your background, you will be better for it, and in her case, very talented. In her biography of her father, John Cheever, very bravely, wrote about him. The New York Times said, in discovering his identity, Susan Cheever discovered her own. And as you'll see in her book, E.E. Cummings, A Life, and in the wonderful Vanity Fair piece that actually is just the preface of the book, you have to buy the book, but that's coming out in March, she knows Cummings very well, and he knew her very well, even at a young age, and he thought she was a very wise and clever woman. She's written many fine things, but like a lot of writers, she sees herself as a journalist, and she started at Newsweek after a stint on a local afternoon newspaper. Remember when we all had afternoon newspapers? That alone should qualify her. She started an afternoon newspaper writing weddings and obituaries, and she loved it. And then she got a job at Newsweek. And after that, you'll have to ask her how she got to write her first book. But it was a real, she's written 15 books, novels and nonfiction, and you see them in your program. And you also have this marvelous piece Andy Kahan has done, where we have joined the Rosenbach, which we've just merged with, the Rosenbach Library, has the Mary Ann Moore collection, including her sofa and everything. And so Cummings and Moore exchanged letters. And as you leave tonight, please take note in the cases. Andy has put together a small exhibit of the exchange of those letters. I mean, this is the kind of thing that this institution brings as firsthand original knowledge. So she is currently working on a book about alcoholism in America, and you can ask her about that. And her great book that we're reading now and is so beautiful to look at, E.E. Cummings, who was a man who used small letters 5 decades before email, so there. So please join me in welcoming the delightful, self-deprecating, and just charming Susan Cheever.
Hi, what a great introduction. Goodness. Thanks, Toby. And thank you for this evening. And, you know, just to say, I don't think there's a writer alive who doesn't owe it all to a library or a series of libraries, and I'm certainly no exception to that. I've spent hours wandering around libraries, wondering which book would change my life and which book would alter it a little bit and which book would just allow me to escape for a couple of hours. And even now, I spend a huge amount of time at the New York Society Library, which is an excellent library if you're ever in Manhattan. And really, this book about alcoholism has got me practically living at the library. So, you know, without libraries, our civilization would be lost. Okay, now, I was very lucky, as I see more and more as I get older, to grow up in a household where there was tremendous passion about literature, about books, and about poems. And every Sunday night, we each had to memorize a poem and recite it to each other. It was like that, something which at the time seemed a little onerous, but now I'm very glad to have those poems in my head. My father and I got a little competitive. We started with Frost and Tennyson, and then I memorized John Greenleaf Whittier's Barbara Frietchie, and then he memorized The Charge of the Light Brigade, and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can imagine, but it was so astonishing to grow up in a household like that. And just to tell one little story, my father and mother were both always giving us books. I have two brothers. And one night, my father gave me Wilkie Collins' The Woman in White. So I started reading it, and of course, I couldn't stop. And so I woke up the next morning very, very sick, way too sick to go to school. And my father came into my room, and he saw the book under my covers. And he said, okay, you don't have to go to school. You know, so it was that kind of household. And one of the things that made it lovely were the stories my father would tell. My father got kicked out of high school, wrote a short story called I Got Expelled from Prep School, came to New York, sold it to the New Republic. Not bad, right? So I, too, as you will hear, tried to get kicked out of high school. It seemed the least I could do. And one of the people that my father talked about a lot was the poet E.E. Cummings. And he told lots of Cummings stories. Cummings had been sort of his mentor in New York City. And I think that the thing my father liked the best about Cummings, besides his poetry, was that Cummings didn't seem to care about money at all. He really, and my father, like most writers, struggled to make a living, and he was always worried, and Cummings just never worried. And so one of my father's favorite stories about Cummings was how Cummings and Marion had been invited to a fabulous, fancy New Year's Eve party on Upper Park Avenue, and they had two subway tokens to their name. And so they got all dressed up. Marion had been a model, so she had something from Givenchy, and Cummings had his white tie and tails from Harvard and his collapsible top hat. He had a collapsible top hat he was very proud of. So up they went on the subway to this fabulous New Year's Eve party with no idea how they would get home. It was an icy night. They had a ball. Nothing could have concerned them less. They were not saying to themselves, oh my God, as I would be, how are we going to get home? And, you know, they were the life of the party. And as the party wound down at about 1:30 in the morning, they got in the elevator, I would say a little drunk, with a banker and his wife. And the banker said to Cummings, what a lovely top hat. And Cummings said, what would you give me to step on it? And the banker said, $10. And the top hat collapsed, and they took a taxi home. So that was the way to live, according to my father. To have that kind of faith that the universe would take care of you just really seemed wonderful to me. And so as you'll read, if you read the book in the preface, on a very cold night in 1958, I went to a school that was not a good match, as they say now. I hated it. It hated me. It was the master school in Dobbs Ferry, New York. We were both guilty. But I heard that Cummings was coming to read at Dobbs, which, as we called the school. And so I mentioned that to my father, and my father drove me down to Dobbs to hear Cummings read that night. And of course, the minute my father walked in, Cummings yelled, "Joey," which was my father's nickname. And they embraced, and, you know, the English department ladies kind of went, "Rrr." Anyway, he gave a brilliant reading, and then he said to my father, "I hope you'll drive me home." So we got into the secondhand Dodge, me in the back seat, Cummings riding shotgun, my father driving, and drove back to New York to Patchen Place, where Cummings lived. And on the way back to New York, Cummings just, he was the funniest man I've ever listened to. And he mocked the school, imitated the head of the English department, nailed them. And he said to my father, he said, "No wonder she's unhappy at this school. She's a spirited young woman, and this is a factory for turning out the wives of bloviated bankers." And, you know, I mean, he went on and on. Then we famously stopped for burgers at White Castle in the Bronx, and my father had a flask. But by that time, I was just in love with Cummings, with the idea of freedom, with the idea, you know, he was allergic to authority, especially at the master's school. And what happened was, because he got it and did these imitations of my teachers and told my father I didn't belong there, I got to go to a different kind of school. It actually worked. I had been saying all these things all along, but they didn't work. I got to go to a wonderful school called the Woodstock Country School, where they didn't care where you did your work. You could do it in a tree, and where taking a walk counted as a phys ed credit. So it's a story with a very happy ending. So that was my night with Cummings. And then about, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago, so let me just jump a little and say there are many different kinds of research. Biographers do research. There's primary source, which means you hold the actual letter in your hand. There's secondary source, which means you're reading a book that somebody wrote where they held the actual letter in their hand, right? And there are interviews, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a fourth kind of research that doesn't have a fancy name that I know of, which is my favorite kind of research, which is you just go there and sit there. And sometimes you learn things. So I found myself, I was teaching at the New School, which is down in Greenwich Village. I found myself wandering around Patchen Place, where Cumming had lived. It's still there, right off 10th Street. It's open. And, you know, it was just because I was in the neighborhood, and I started thinking about that night. And there are a couple of plaques on his building. And I put a letter through the letter slot. And the woman who lives there with her family called me right up. And so I went and had tea in Cummings' old living room. And I began to reread the poems. And I didn't know what I was doing. I never do. But I became obsessed all over again with Cummings. And then I had dinner with a couple of friends, and I was doing my "What's My Next Book?" And we started to talk, and it became clear that my next book was a biography of Cummings. And I hope, as I was saying at dinner, one of the great things about biography is you get to bring people back to life. And, I mean, what could be better? And I hope that I was able to do that in this book. I want to say a word about biography, because I did some odd things in this book. I think biography is the sort of dowager of nonfiction. You know, most nonfiction has really changed, but you can read a biography published today that is almost the same as it would have been 100 years ago. But it's about to come crashing down. You heard it here. It's being eaten away by memoir already. For instance, it's very hard to find a magazine profile where the writer is not a character, right? And it's good that it's being eaten away by memoir, because I think we more and more question authority. And biography, of course, is not objective. You choose your facts to tell the story you want to tell. And so it seems to me only fair that the biographer should say, "And this is who I am." And I think people want that now. They want to know who is speaking, who is choosing these facts for me, who is stringing these facts together. And one of the things that's changing in biography is it used to be that biography always began with the birth of the subject or the birth of the subject's parents, right? Now That hardly ever happens. But a biographer has to choose. Is it going to be the funniest moment in the subject's life? Is it going to be the beginning? Is it going to be the end? Is it going, when Blake Bailey wrote about my father, he chose the lowest moment in my father's life, which is also one of the funniest. I'll just tell that story because it's such a great story. So my father was dying of alcoholism. Already a big laugh, and teaching at BU, and he had rented a humble little apartment off Kenmore Square, but he was very confused, and he would get sober the next year, so it actually has a happy ending. But John Updike had made plans to go to the symphony with my father, so John arrives at the door of my father's apartment building, and he sees my father come out of his apartment on the landing naked, and then he sees that my father has locked himself out of his apartment. And so there is naked John Cheever and John Updike coming to pick him up and no clothes. And so John gives my father his jacket. My father was about 5'2", Updike was about 6'2". So it looked more like a dress, and out they went into the cold looking for a locksmith. So that's the opening of Blake Bailey's biography of my father, and that was an interesting choice, but I decided to start my biography of E.E. Cummings at the high point. I decided to give him that. And the high point for Cummings, I think, he may totally disagree with me, is the point, you know, Cummings was Harvard-born and bred. He grew up two blocks from Harvard Yard. His father was a Harvard professor. His parents, as you'll hear, were set up on a date by William James. This is very good. His neighbors were Josiah Royce and the Jameses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the age of 3, he had a little Harvard sweater, the whole thing. And he got an undergraduate degree from Harvard and a master's from Harvard. Mm. But Cummings came to really dislike everything that Harvard and Cambridge stood for. Harvard was very homogenous. It was run by a man, Abbot Lowell, who instituted a Jewish quota, who had trials to get homosexuals kicked out of Harvard, who actually was on the commission that decided that Sacco and Vanzetti should be executed. Not a nice guy. So Cummings came to despise all that. And also, of course, the Cambridge society in which he grew up, nobody drank, nobody talked about sex, piano legs were covered with little dresses, right? So once he discovered sex and drinking and having fun, and it wasn't rock and roll, but poetry, he decided that he couldn't stay in Cambridge, and he moved to Greenwich Village, where he lived happily for 40 years. So the triumphant moment, and the one that I begin the book with, is the moment when he returns to Harvard to give the Charles Eliot Norton lectures in 1952. So this is a moment of great reconciliation and triumph, and he's as nervous as a cat. Right? When they first ask him to do it, he's like, I don't know. So they tell him that he can just talk for 15 minutes. It's like, here, I'm going to talk for 30 minutes and then 30-minute Q&A. They tell him he can talk for 15 minutes and then just read his favorite poems. That Aaron Copland just talked for 20 minutes and then played some music. There, you know, the correspondence between John Finley and Cummings, trying to get Cummings to come and do this, is pretty funny. But he went and he did it. And the lectures were a huge success. There's actually, I was just listening to an audio of the third lecture, and you can hear the students rapping on the window trying to get in from the fire escape. It was so crowded. It was just great. Anyway, to me, that's the high point, the coming back to Harvard where he had grown up, and kind of reconciling with everything, all things Harvard. And so I just thought I would read to you the two opening pages of chapter one, which are about that. And then I thought I would talk about a couple of the poems. And then I thought you would ask me questions. So here's chapter one of this book. Boy, and you know, when you read somebody's first paragraph, you just know they had it every which way before they finally settled. And I'm still not sure about these first two sentences, but it's too late. so I can stop worrying. Okay, it's called Odysseus Returns to Cambridge. There was no aged dog to welcome him. Thank you. And no and no murderous suitors for him to deceive, but E.E. Cummings was a nervous wreck. Professor John H. Finley, Jr., introducing Cummings at Memorial Hall, kept saying that Cummings' return to Harvard after more than 30 years was like Odysseus' return to Ithaca, but the 58-year-old Cummings, held together by a neck-to-hip corset that he called the Iron Maiden, and attended by his beautiful, homesick common-law wife, did not feel at all victorious or Homeric. Many of the women in his audience, however, were as ecstatic as Penelope was when she finally recognized her long-absent husband. This is a quote. There was a hush when he walked out onto the stage, says Joanne Puttee, who was a Radcliffe student studying Greek with Finley and who had been dragged to the lecture by her mother. He was enchanting, captivating, and magnetic. He was very virile and sexual on the stage. I think he made some of the men uncomfortable. Decades had passed since Cummings had jubilantly stood on the same vast stage. You know, if you've never been to Sanders Theater at Memorial Hall in Harvard, go there. It is the most extraordinary theater in the world, I would say. Okay, maybe. One of them. Decades had passed since Cummings had jubilantly stood on the same vast stage, and with the cheekiness of youth, given a controversial class lecture as a magna cum laude for his own Harvard class. Back then, in 1915, he had been a true son of Harvard. He had grown up in a large frame house a few blocks away from Memorial Hall at the crossroads of Irving and Farrar, and he stayed on at Harvard for an extra year after graduation to get a master's degree in classics. Now, on a late October night in 1952, with the crescent moon high over Harvard Yard, he was returning in glory as the distinguished Charles Eliot Norton lecturer to give a prestigious series of six lectures for $15,000 in Harvard's Sanders Theater within the ornate Memorial Hall, a fur-bellowed Victorian Gothic giant that had been built after the Civil War to honor the Union dead. His self-imposed exile from Cambridge, a town he had come to hate for its intellectualism, Puritan uptightness, racism and self-righteous xenophobia had seemed necessary for him as a man and as a poet. Soon after his 1915 class lecture and after serving in World War I, Cummings had permanently fled to sexy, law-breaking Greenwich Village, where he could hang out with other modernist poets like Marianne Moore, talk with writers like Hart Crane, be admired by Dylan Thomas and Edna St. Vincent Millay, have an affair with another man's wife, go to burlesque performances at the National Winter Garden, and ask William Carlos Williams for medical advice. He had no regrets about leaving his hometown of Cambridge, which liked to compare itself to Athens. One of his earliest poems, a sonnet, brilliantly, angrily takes its measure and finds it wanting. Okay, I'm going to read this poem. It's a sonnet. The Cambridge ladies who live in furnished souls are unbeautiful and have comfortable minds. Also with the church's Protestant blessings, daughters, unscented, shapeless, spirited. They believe in Christ and Longfellow, both dead, are invariably interested in so many things. At the present writing, one still finds delighted fingers knitting for the, is it poles? Perhaps. While permanent faces coyly bandy scandal of Mrs. N and Professor D. The Cambridge ladies do not care above Cambridge if sometimes in its box of sky, lavender and cornerless, the moon rattles like a fragment of angry candy. So that's how he felt about Cambridge. And, you know, just a footnote, the Cummings house is still in Cambridge at the corner of Irving, Farrar, and Scott, and it's owned by Abby Rockefeller, and she's put up a wall which keeps you from even seeing what's going on in there. And on the wall, she's put, the Cambridge ladies live in furnished souls. And I just think, if you were in Cambridge, would you put that on your wall? But... but she did. Okay, I'm just going to read two more paragraphs of this. Still, he had come back, and standing at the polished maple lectern beneath a frieze of carved laurels, he was in the presence of some major ghosts, including the specter of his own notorious youth. Before Cummings was even born, his redoubtable father, the Reverend Edward Cummings, a Harvard professor and a member of the class of 83, had played Julius Caesar in a college production on the boards of the Sanders. Cummings had spent most of the summer before his first Charles Eliot Norton lecture trying to calm his anxieties by writing and rewriting and rehearsing both the lectures. Typically, he called them non-lectures. And the poems he planned to read. He decided that in the first lecture he would speak on the subject of his distinguished parents, his New Hampshire-born father and his mother Rebecca, whose family came over on the Mayflower. His parents were Harvard royalty. You already know this. They had been introduced by their friend and future Cambridge neighbor, the philosopher William James. How would Cummings be able to take this haunted stage and make it his own? So that's where I decided to start, at a very triumphant high point. And it was interesting because I tried to find everybody who was still alive who had been there on October 28th of 1952. And I found some people, Joanne Poteet, obviously, but I found a couple of guys who had gone and not liked it. Or one of them, Ben Lafarge, went to the lecture and thought it was okay, but then he went to the party. The Jameses gave a party afterwards. He went to the party and thought that Marion was too tall for Cummings. So I'm not sure what that's about. But anyway, one of the questions that I've been asked is, what would I ask Cummings if I could sit down and chat with him now? And I think the thing that fascinates me the most that I don't understand at all is how he did it, where he got the patterns that he uses. I mean, as you know, he experiments with upper and lower case. He experiments with parts of speech. He experiments with the line. He experiments with using different kinds of words. So I'm just going to, you know, read a poem that you all know, and then just another very short one, and tell you the things I'd like to ask him that I can't figure out. So this is a poem he wrote when he was very young, 23. He was working at a job at Collier's Publishing, which he hated, and he read in the newspaper that William Cody, that Buffalo Bill, had died. And so he went back to his little room and wrote this. Buffalo Bill's defunct, who used to ride a water-smooth silver stallion and break 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pigeons just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. And what I want to know is, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? So I'd like to ask him how he came up with that word defunct, right? Buffalo Bill's defunct. I would have used died, and it wouldn't have been as good. So that's the kind of thing that he was very secretive about. There's one not very nice story about he had a daughter. She was essentially abducted by her mother, and they didn't see each other for 30 years, and then they saw each other again. I'm leaving out all the juicy parts. And she, at one point, was staying at his house and sleeping in the guest room, which was also the room where he worked. And his poetry was sort of spread out on the table. And she started asking him questions about how he wrote these poems and where he got these things. And his wife, Marion, kicked her out. She said, "You never ask him. You have to leave now." So that was actually how secretive he was about it. And then that's an early poem. I'm going to read a very late poem that also fascinates me. And then I also would like to ask how he did this. Again, 7 lines. Me up at does, out of the floor, quietly stare, a poisoned mouse. Still who alive is asking, what have I done that you wouldn't have? So I want to ask him, did you start a poisoned mouse was staring at me from the floor and then decide, where did you get me up at does? You know, and it's so great. It gives it so much power. One of the things about Cummings that I think many people misunderstand is that he was really a formalist. In other words, he had studied poetry He knew everything about poetics. He was fluent in Latin. He was fluent in Greek. And so it wasn't that he wasn't, it wasn't that anything he did on the page was casual. He was taking, the Cambridge Ladies, for instance, is a Petrarchan sonnet, guys, right? So he was taking these forms and squeezing them to make them more powerful. And so they're anything but casual, but they look sort of casual. You know, it's that classy Cummings thing, right? I look like I'm doing nothing at all here, but in fact, I'm writing an astonishing poem. So those are the poems I wanted to share with you. And I think that if I tell you more, you won't want to read the book. So I'm not going to tell you anymore. So now you have to ask me questions.
Well, I have a question before our mic handlers get down here. Uh-huh. I wonder, and I have a feeling you may not know the answer, or maybe you do, but if you could talk a bit about how his personality and the traits that you witnessed, as well as his situation in modernism, affected his poetry or helped create it.
Okay, that's like five questions.
Yeah, I think it's two. But
well, the personality, one of the things that fascinated me about Cummings, besides the fact that I owed him a favor, is that he was very angry. You know, I think many people who are allergic to authority are pretty angry. And he used that anger to create gold out of straw. He used that anger as a creative force. And I also am very angry. And so funny people are often angry. And anger is very unpopular these days, but actually I'm hoping for it. It'll have a comeback. Anyway, that was the thing about his personality that I think you were trying to get me to say, is that he used this anger to fuel his creativity, and that sort of fascinates me. And yes, he was very angry. You know, when Jackie Kennedy invited him to the White House, he said, "No thanks, poets don't go to the White House." And you know, you can see his point. On the other hand, really. So.
And then can you situate him within sort of some of the major tenets of modernism?
Well, I mean, my contention about Cummings is that he's the only American modernist. So he came along at a time when everything was being called into question, not only in poetry, but in music and in art. So you have Marcel Duchamp. You should all go to the museum and see that those incredible works that you're so lucky to have. But people just overturning the apple cart. And he wasn't the only person doing this in poems at all. Ezra Pound's brilliant poem, The Return, was a great influence on Cummings. Gertrude Stein was an influence on Cummings. Amy Lowell was an influence on Cummings. There were a lot of people who came to believe, I mean, there are different schools of modernism, but Cummings believed that a poem should be a little bit difficult, that you should have a little trouble with it, and then there should be a burst of understanding. He wanted to stop you in your tracks and make you notice things. So, you know, if that was important then, how much more important it is now. And that's also, of course, what Picasso was trying to do. I'm not an art historian, but to oversimplify, to break things apart and put them together in new ways. And even as in painting, they stopped representing the figure, right? In poetry, they stopped representing the figure. And as in painting, they said these abstract forms can move you, can speak to your heart in the same way that representation can. In poetry, they said to themselves, we're going to use just the sounds. My father moved through dooms of love, through ams of have, through, what is it, saves of give. You know, the sound of it is a dirge, right? You don't even have to know what the words mean. So the same thing was going on, and it was called modernism. And Cummings was very much a modernist poet. I think perhaps our only modernist poet.
But then he also worked within traditional structures, as you pointed out, with the Petrarchan.
Well,
form.
He took traditional structures and modernized them, so to speak, to use that word very inaccurately.
It's all right. Any questions from the audience? Just raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you.
Making a distinction between having opinions about something and being active in society and in establishing things around those opinions. Did he take any activist stance in regard to the politics of his time in the 30s and 40s, something more than just having opinions? And also, did he take any active role in exploring religious belief as opposed to just having opinions about it?
Well, yes. Religious belief, I'm not so sure, so let me answer the first question first. So when World War One was, when we entered World War One, he joined the ambulance corps and went to France and drove an ambulance on the Western Front and ended up, for reasons that I'm not going to go into, you have to read the book, incarcerated in a French prison camp for 3 months. So he was very active in terms of, although the reason why they put him in a prison camp was they said to him, I mean, he had done some obnoxious things, but they said to him, do you hate the Germans? And he refused to say yes. He said, no, I love the French. And that ended him up being incarcerated for 3 months. So that's not political activism so much. But then in the 1930s, many people in Cummings' circle had gone to Russia, which was the sort of promised land of the 1920s and 30s in certain New York City circles. And everybody was saying, oh, it's so wonderful there. They've really figured it out. It's, you know, well, you've read Animal Farm. We know how this story ends. But Cummings got there in 1933 at exactly the wrong time. So everybody who went before was like, oh, this is so wonderful. But Cummings, you have to remember, was allergic to authority. So what he saw was a very frightened people. And he saw, before most people saw, what Stalin was doing. And he became virulently anti-communist. Virulently, furiously. And so, in the 1950s, he thought that Senator McCarthy was right. Because he was still so angry and so upset by what he had actually seen in Moscow. Now, he didn't. I know that if they had called him before the House Un-American Activities Committee, he would have told them where to put it. You know, he would have been like Pete Seeger and said, I'll sing to you, but I'm not going to answer your questions. But, but you know, he got confused about Russia. And although he wasn't political, he didn't go out and campaign. It was, you know, one of the fascinating things about biography, or one of the terrible things, is that you have to create a context which both honors the world in which the people lived and somehow honors what we think we know now. And of course, you can't just take, or I don't believe, you can't just take what we know now and impose it on them. That's imperialism, right? We don't necessarily have, it's not, we're civilized and they're heathens. On the other hand, you can't ignore what we know now because we know it. So it's a complicated thing. And with Cummings, I found it particularly complicated. He wanted very much to fight in World War II and couldn't get drafted for obvious reasons. The Iron Maiden being one of them. He was already wearing it in 1942. But you bring up a more interesting general question, which is, should artists take part in politics? And the answer to that is, I don't know, but I do know that it's a question that's debated over and over and over again with no satisfactory answer. So,
I always thought The Enormous Room was one of the most extraordinary depictions of life in prison. And could you comment on the effect that you think his time there had on the remainder of his career?
The Enormous Room is the book that Cummings wrote about his three-month incarceration in a French concentration camp. I guess we can't call it that. In a French prison. And his attitude toward it, and this won't surprise you, was, isn't this fun? He wrote letters home to his mother. He found, you know, it was a prison where they all lived on these straw, bug-infested mattresses in a large room, which had once actually been a chapel, which he called The Enormous Room. And there's actually a lovely moment because they bring him in at night and it's pitch dark, so he can't see, he can only hear. And he has this sense of enormity of all these people, all these men in the dark. But he wrote it because his father immediately tried to get him out of prison. And his father was a man who was not used to having trouble making things happen as he wanted them to happen. And then there was a terrible thing where by mistake they got a telegram saying that Cummings had gone down on the SS Antilles. I mean, it was terrible. And so by the time Cummings got out, his father was so angry that he was going to sue the United States government and President Wilson and everybody else. And Cummings persuaded him that it would be more effective to write a book. And his father actually paid him to write the book. And Cummings was very relieved that there was no big lawsuit. But I think that it really tested his gallantry. Cummings' whole attitude towards all difficulty was, isn't this wonderful? And he managed it in the enormous room. But by the time he got home, he was very sick and exhausted. But I think I don't know how it affected the rest of his life. You know, he just kept on loving France. There's that. And he kept on pretending that being on the Western Front, which was actually extremely dangerous, was just a kind of lark. But I think he was able, I think it, if anything, it kind of, it confirmed his attitude that the world will take care of you if you just chuckle. I'm not saying this exactly right, but, you know, if you're gallant and uncomplaining and see that this guy used to paint Commodore Vanderbilt's horses, I mean, all kinds of people were in this camp, right? Defrocked priests, sailors, it was a fascinating place, that somehow everything will be all right. And that's one of the things I love about him, is that sense that, you know, you just have to trust. You just have to, you're going to get home from the party. Your book is going to get published. I mean, Cummings, like most writers, had very extreme ups and downs. He was a prodigy at Harvard. He got published before he had left Harvard in a book called Six Harvard Poets. And then by the 1930s, he couldn't get published. And he had written a significant book of poems, couldn't get it published. It was rejected by 15 publishers. He borrowed $300 from his mother, published it privately, called it No Thanks, and dedicated it to the 15 publishers who had turned it down. May they live in infamy, right? It's somewhat embarrassing to them now. But he had a terrible time, and then he became popular again. So I hope I answered your question.
Oh, okay. Susan, you mentioned anger. How does that work for you as a writer, the pros and cons of it?
Well, I try not to kill anybody. How do you mean? Can you be more the pros and cons of anger?
What I meant was, stimulate your writing? Does it hold you back? Do you have times when you say, "I am too angry to write about what I'm wanting to write about today"?
Well, no. I think one of the things that drives my writing is anger. Anger that, you know, I'm just very bossy. And so when the world gets it wrong, I have to write a book so that they get it right. Do you know what I mean? Take Alcoholism in America, this book I'm writing as we speak, that's already overdue. As I was saying at dinner, you know, Americans have a very intense relationship to alcohol. It's good and it's bad. It started with the pilgrims who were, believe me, so drunk that they landed in the wrong place. There are documents. And, you know, we have Grant, who was the best general we've ever had drunk and the worst president we've ever had sober. So it does all kinds of interesting things throughout American history. But one of the things about it is that we swing in American history. There's a 100-year pendulum. So in 1830, we're the drunkest country in the world, and in 1930, we outlaw alcohol, right? That's how crazy we are. And I'm afraid we're going back towards prohibition, and it terrifies me because prohibition emphatically didn't work. So I have to write a book now that says, don't do that! So in that way, do you see what it's indignation? Or, you know, in the case of my father, who I knew was gay, I wanted to write the book that would present that in a loving and beautiful way, instead of letting somebody else run with it. So it's anger, indignation, all those things, and I don't, you know, anger is such a complicated thing, and I know that, I mean, I've noticed it's very unpopular now. If you say blah, blah, blah is an angry person, that's a very bad thing to say about them. Yet, it seems to me, we live in a sort of culture of anger where people kill each other over parking spaces. So it's a little bit confusing, but what interests me is writers who are angry and how that fuels their anger. And I would certainly argue that my father was one of those writers as well.
Lady all the way in back on the right.
I think I heard that you compared him to Henry David Thoreau.
Cummings.
Yeah, that he was this generation's Henry David Thoreau.
Maybe. Yes.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Yes.
If you could just tell me how that is.
Well, they were both people who didn't like rules, didn't like convention, wanted to do things in a different way, wanted to show that money is not important. If you reread Walden, it's a very angry book. Oh, my goodness. A scorching book, especially on the subject of rich people. You know, it's really, he was really angry. And it wasn't about, sorry, Mike, it wasn't about being a hermit. He never said he was going to be a hermit. There's all this brouhaha about how he was really a hypocrite because he went into town for lunch every day, but that was always the idea. I mean, essentially, it was his first apartment. He had gotten kicked out of the Emerson's house for a variety of reasons. He didn't want to go home and live with his mother. He didn't know where he was going to live. Emerson had this piece of land on Walden Pond, and he said, why don't you go, you know, live in a packing crate out there? And Thoreau essentially did. And to the magic of Q&A, Thoreau thought he had gone to Walden to, I realize this is a tangent, to write a book about his going up the Merrimack River with his brother, and that's what he was doing at Walden, but his friend Nathaniel Hawthorne asked him to come over to Salem and give a talk about the Merrimack book. So he went to Salem, and in the Q&A, all anybody wanted to know was, what's it like to live in a hut on Walden Pond? And at that point, Thoreau started writing Walden. So there you go.
Tell you what, before we sign off, I thought it would be fun if, two things, if you wouldn't mind talking about his adventures in pornography with regard to his writing, and then read that poem that you, if you wouldn't mind, that you read on the air earlier today, because
poem.
The rhythms are so wonderful.
I'm not going to ask you to read the other part. Do you know what page it's on, though? I have to find it. This is a poem I have to say I like a lot. And if this is pornography, what's that thing? I know it when I see it. Okay. May I feel, said he. I'll squeal, said she. Just once, said he. It's fun, said she. May I touch, said he. How much, said she. A lot, said he. Why not, said she. Let's go, said he. Not too far, said she. What's too far, said he. Where you are, said she. May I stay, said he. Which way, said she. Like this, said he. If you kiss, said she. May I move, said he. Is it love, said she. If you're willing, said he. But you're killing, said she. But it's life, said he. But your wife, said she. Now, said he. Ow, said she. Tip top, said he. Don't stop, said she. Oh, no, said he. Go slow, said she. Come, said he. Said she. You're divine, said he. You're mine, said she.
Susan Cheever, reading E.E. Cummings. Thank you and good night. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.